So this year at SEMA, last year we had a section dedicated to EVs, right? SEMA's about cars.
Yep.
They don't want to pick a lane. We should not pick a lane. We just like cars. We like car people. Whatever the car is, fine. This year we're going to add to that, and we're going to have alternative
Except
fuels.
Those lifted trucks outside.
Yeah, I hate trucks.
Yeah, we
square body trucks should not be part of the industry. No, I love it all. So this year there'll be a whole section of the show that's about alternative fuels, whether it's hydrogen or propane or renewables like ethanol.
So they're expanding on that beyond.
They want to open up the discussion.
Last year it was just EV. It was
right.
An EV section.
And I think it'll help. Everybody can get smarter about what's really going on and what's available and how's it work and. What's the window on getting clean hydrogen? Because hydrogen, you got water dribbling out your exhaust pipe. It's awesome.
Yep.
So I think to accept EVs as the only solution is to be really not very curious about everything else that's happening. So it's probably, like a lot of things, all of the above is a better solution than just picking one.
Sure.
But in particular, personally, I'm not a fan of the government picking one. I think you guys should pick one, and I should pick one, and we should pick what we want.
Let the market decide.
Yeah.
I mean, the government generally does a pretty good job with the decision-making process, right?
Welcome to Oil and Whiskey, an Ironclad original. I am Josh Henning.
I'm Phil Gerber.
I'm Jeremy Gerber.
Welcome to Oil and Whiskey, an Ironclad original. Today's guest, right here in the studio. We always love it when it's in studio
instead of
a Zoom. They're always better. Founder and owner of Blueprint Engines and member of SEMA's Board of Directors, Norris Marshall. You can learn more about Norris Marshall at BlueprintEngines.com and follow him on Instagram at Blueprint_Engines. Norris Marshall, welcome to Oil and Whiskey.
Hey, well,
that's as formal as we're going to get.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I traveled a great distance to be here and be part of this because I think you guys are awesome. I'm looking forward to it.
I appreciate it. Hope you feel the same way when it's over.
I probably won't.
Just don't tell us either way.
Okay.
Well, we got to get this started off by pouring some of this very interesting looking bourbon. It's not often that something shows up that I've never seen before.
I know.
And this is, I mean, what a beautiful package that came in.
By far the best looking bottle in the collection.
It is. Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, World Whiskey Society Reserve Collection. Man.
You asked earlier if this has been good for the business, and I said the jury's still out. But the one thing it has been good for is getting gifts, and that's been knives and whiskey and stuff like that. Now, so many times people bring gifts when they start and they come out to be a guest on the podcast, and there's sometimes whiskey related stuff. You're kind of like, oh, you know, when you're looking your grandma in the face, and you're like, I wanted footy pajamas at 21 years old, you know? And it's just that you got to be – that's just something that's super excited about. That's really cool, especially, like, if you said if you don't know anything about it. Oh.
Well, let's see if it deserves all the admiration that you're giving it.
It's a
15-year Kentucky Straight Bourbon whiskey, so I don't know how
the bottle's bad. The bottle's hard to hold, but – there's a marketing guy that designed that bottle.
He'd like hands twice the size.
So you said you traveled great distance. Where'd you come from?
We're out of Kearney, Nebraska. That's pretty much where I've been my whole life. Grew up there.
Really?
Kearney is right in the middle of the state. So most of the population in Nebraska is in eastern end in Lincoln and Omaha, and our town is about 35,000 people. We have a couple of hospitals, a branch of the university, a few manufacturing plants, and a lot of cornfields.
I'm going to get you just a little closer. When you move over and look at me, sometimes you're cutting out just a little bit.
But. Okay.
Yep. Cheers.
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 That's quite nice.
It's probably appropriate.
Perfect.
That's real good.
That is great. Yeah, it lives up to the beautiful bottle it comes in.
Yeah, I was looking at the mash bill on the side. That's really good.
So are you guys all whiskey connoisseurs?
Consumers? Yeah.
I'm not connoisseurs.
You got some of that Pappy Van Winkle stuff here somewhere?
We do.
Well, yeah. That was a great guest they had that time, man.
Oh, yeah. Now, that one, unfortunately, we had to flip the bill for. But if anybody wants to gift us, we'd gladly accept it. But, yeah, there's a little row of it. We've got each and every one of them there, all the year ranges. Awesome. So if you're a bourbon guy, we'll pour you some before you get out of here.
You would be wasting it on me. I'm not much of a bourbon guy, but I have friends that talk about it enough. I've heard that name before.
Yeah, I don't know if we definitely wouldn't be labeled connoisseurs. Like you said, we've drank enough to know a little bit to be dangerous.
Connoisseur, we know more about cars, a little bit about motors, but you're the motor guy, right?
Yeah.
So we got lots to talk about.
You've been in Nebraska pretty much your whole life.
Right.
You've built quite the empire in the engine world. There's a gap in between there. You born in Nebraska and where we're at today.
Yeah. You want that story?
That's a lot to cover.
Okay.
Let's start unpacking it.
I can do it. As you can imagine, I've told the story before.
I'm sure.
So I grew up on a farm, and before I even came along, my dad was a 1950s hot rodder. So in 1955, he had the proverbial flat-top haircut, had a 29 Model A Roadster with a flathead Ford in it. And he did that, built that when he was in high school, and then later he did some drag racing and some circle track racing, and then he got married and became a farmer. So all that stopped. By the time I came along, he was done. But I grew up hearing those stories about that, and that's really what lit the fire for me, was hearing stories from my dad talking about the things he had done. So I wanted to repeat all that and became very interested. So as a farm kid, in high school, instead of working on the farm, I went to town and worked in garages and shops and things like that. When I was 15, I built my first engine, and I copied an article in CarCraft magazine in April of 1977. There was an article in there about an engine that Jack Roush had built, where he took a baseline 302 and made it into a 302 Boss engine. And I thought, that sounds like a good project for a 15-year-old. So I gathered up the parts, bought them in salvage yard and things like that. My mom would haul me around to get them, and had a local shop do the machine work on it. I was going to put this engine in a 69 Ford pickup, and that was a hand-me-down from the hired hand on the farm. It was a beater. I got all done with the engine except for one part. I was missing an intake manifold. So the article was about Jack Roush and him doing this. It's 1977 or 78. So I got on the phone, I called information. Back then, you didn't have Google. You guys are too young to know.
I remember that.
You dial those two or three numbers, you call information. I said, hey, I need a phone number for Jack Roush in Livonia, Michigan. And I got a phone number, and I called him. I said, I'm building this engine. I need an intake manifold. He said, I'll sell you an intake manifold for $75. And he did. Came COD to my house, and my mom paid for it. So that was the first engine I ever built.
Wow.
And I was, deep into Hot Rod magazine, CarCraft magazine. I really liked the engine part. I built a few cars or painted cars. I was not a very good body man. I really didn't like that part, but I really liked the engine part. When I was a senior in high school, I got a job at that same shop that had worked on that 302, and I learned the trade of engine machining. And essentially, two or three years later, I quit and opened my own machine shop, and the story continues from there.
Before we get too far into that story, so you said that all those stories about your dad racing, building all those motors, doing the drag race stuff, flatheads, all that, that's what got you into it. So I'm sure you'd heard those stories a bunch of times. You had built that stuff up in your head. Specifically, how fast did you build up the flathead in your head to be? And then how big of a letdown was that, the first flathead that you built?
So my dad would free, and he's still with us. He's 86 years old. He would freely admit that it wasn't all perfection, right? Like, I found a picture of this Model A Roadster, and it's a 29 body on a 33 frame rail, and the tires and the wheel wells don't line up at all. I mean, they're like 6 inches off. And I'm like, Dad, I asked him this a year ago. I said, tires and the wheel wells don't line up. He said, man, I was 15 years old when I built that. He said, that was the best I could do. And I think he later regretted, but he took the engine out of that Model A Roadster and put it in a dragster. And back then, it's kind of like a slingshot dragster. But I think he only went 110 mile an hour and a quarter with it. It wasn't anything too rocket ship, but maybe for the late 50s, that was okay.
Oh, yeah.
You ever wonder about, I always think about this, with some of those like 40s, 50s hot rods where people kind of, they idolize them and they look at them as though like maybe they found a survivor, they found an old picture of one, and they try to like mimic that car, bring it back to life. But
the bad ways too.
With the that car back then could have been like that car at the NSRA Nationals that's way out in the corner of the parking lot that you're looking at being like, ooh. You know,
and guys that would know that car back then, they're seeing us replicate. Like, this is so cool. It's like a barn find. Like, that was the worst car. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
The Flathead stuff specifically, we've talked about it and, you know, busted a few balls on this podcast before about
Mike Herman specifically.
I love the Flathead engine. I love looking at it. I love hearing it. I idolized it. You growing up and you see all of the magazine stuff and the tires going up in smoke and you just think that it's the coolest thing. I had several of them. I built a few of them. And the first time behind the wheel, loved the sound of it. And when you, that lack of ass was like a, man, well,
all 78 horsepower right there, huh?
Yeah. Sounds great.
But yeah, nostalgia is pretty cool. not very realistic.
So you went to that shop. You've been there a few years. And you said, I've got what it takes. I know how to do my own business.
Well, I knew I could figure out how to have a machine shop because that's what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And it was a small shop. There were two employees. As a matter of fact, while I was in high school, the main guy quit and I became the main guy, right? So I'm finishing high school and I'm running this shop. Had a great mentor there. My boss, Don, taught me a lot. Give him a lot of credit. But eventually, my entrepreneurial drive took over, and I just really wanted to be in business for myself, and that's what I knew how to do. So I had $3,500, and I bought some boring and honing equipment, a valve grinder, made a hot tank to clean blocks, and hung out my shingle. Opened up a business, and I was doing valve jobs and block work for other people.
On just automotive?
Yeah. Just automotive stuff.
Performance-based or just general mechanic repair?
Well, because I, too, was kind of into racing. I was trying to do some dirt track racing at the time. I had all those buddies that were into racing that wanted me to do work for them. Now, the only problem is they don't pay very good, right? So I went through all of that where I was building engines for my buddies and going to the races every Saturday night and supporting what they were trying to do, dirt track stuff, you know, street stock and maybe a little bit of limited late model kind of cars.
Trading out labor. One of them guys was probably a plumber. You needed some stuff here, so we'll trade out.
One of them worked for a burial vault company, so I didn't have anything. I didn't have anything to trade.
That's not a good trade. Yeah.
But I kind of figured out that it was really hard to make a living in motorsports. I didn't have the experience. We didn't have the customer base in Nebraska for that. I mean, I knew guys were making a living building racing engines, but they weren't around where I was at, and we didn't have that kind of racing. So I consciously decided to kind of not be involved with racing and focus more on just stock replacement engines and fixing up people's engines that were broke. So I did that, had this machine shop. Eventually, within a couple of years, I had three or four employees, which for where I'm from, a machine shop with three employees is pretty big. And I think I was 22 years old, and I thought, man, this is going to get pretty darn boring for the next 40 years, right? And I thought, what else can we do? We've got to have another step. I'm always interested in the next step. And I became aware that there were production shops that were building engines like in a factory setting. And I thought, that sounds good. I found one of them was in Kansas. And I looked up that company, and they had 322 employees, and I had three. And I thought, I don't know if it's possible to have 323 employees, but I know you can have 322 because somebody already did it. So it kind of changed what we were doing. We started buying used engines in the salvage yard and rebuilding them and offering them for sale. And that became pretty successful.
What year was this?
Probably 1986.
Where were you offering them for sale?
Local newspapers in Nebraska. So everybody had a weekly or a daily newspaper.
305s, 350s.
Put a little ad in the back in the classified. Yep, have 5 or 6 engines listed, 350 Chevy, 400 Ford, 390 Ford, stuff like that. And I was selling engines. And that expanded and grew to where we were selling a lot of parts stores around the country. Peak was in about 2000. the year 2000, we were making and selling about 100 replacement engines a day. And then it started slowing down. And it started slowing down because they started making vehicles last longer. When I was doing this, I had buddies in the industry that were doing the same thing. And all together, we were rebuilding and selling about 4 million engines a year, the whole industry was. Wow. And today, it's about 400,000. So I watched all my buddies, almost all my buddies, go broke doing this. They had factories, and I had a factory.
When you were doing 100 a day, how many employees did you have then?
270. Wow. So here's the fun part. It took a few years of business sucking before we realized it's not coming back. At first, you think it's coming back. Oh, it's an economy, you know, it's a downturn, it'll come back.
Any day now.
Yeah, and finally we realized it's never coming back. Cars last longer, engines last longer, electronic fuel injection. Cars had airbags in them. You could pop the airbags on a 60,000-mile car, and that baby's going to the salvage yard because it costs a lot of money to put the airbag back in. So there's lots of good engines in the salvage yard. So the industry went away, and here I am probably, you know, 45, 50 years old, and I'm like, I need something to do that we can make a living doing. So I went back to where I started with the performance stuff. And that was the beginning of Blueprint Engines. Yep, that was the beginning of Blueprint Engines. And then when we first started, Blueprint Engines were basically a rebuilt engine with a hot cam. And then we said, no, we need better heads. We need better this. And eventually we started making parts or having parts made to the point where we had every part for basically a small block Chevy or certain Ford engines, we make ourselves now. So it's an all new engine. And
block included?
Block included. Our blocks come from a foundry in Germany. And if you drive a Chevrolet pickup, it's probably the same foundry that Chevrolet got it out of. And we have 15 or 18 big CNC machines that we machine the blocks. So we do all of the design and development of every part of the engine and manufacture quite a bit of it. And when we don't manufacture it, it's manufactured by a third party for us, like a connecting rod manufacturer, for example, makes our connecting rods. And we do testing, we do calibration, we do the CARB and EPA work where we can, where we're trying to make a compliant engine. And then we make engines and sell them. And we sell them direct to consumer, and we sell them through major catalog distributors. And we no longer don't even have people there that know how to rebuild an engine. We only really know how to make new engines now.
Wow, that's awesome. Back in 2000, you said it was a heyday. That was the peak. You're running 100 engines a day. Two questions. One, obviously, you got other buddies out there. Y'all are building that many. There was always a supply of blocks and
used engines.
Of used engines?
There was then. There was then. So now it's not that way. And so when we started Blueprint, the basic engine was a 383 small block Chevy type engine. And for the builders today that are trying to build performance engines out of a used engine block, they really are struggling to get enough blocks. And so that was another reason. We knew that eventually we wouldn't be able to get those blocks. So we made the investment. When we make a block, it takes one of my designers about 4 months to draw it. And then the tooling, the molds and things like that to make the casting are about $600,000 to $700,000. And then we have a raw casting that we can now machine. And gives us great quality control because on one side of the building we're machining the block and on the other side of the building we're assembling it into an engine and putting it on a dyno. So it's a really short path, right? We really like doing it ourselves so that we can see, make sure everything's working.
And that block only is in your engines?
Today, it only is in our engine, although we do have a distributor customer that is going to be selling those blocks in the future, and he is a bulk purchaser of semi-truck quantities when we have extra, and you'll be able to buy those blocks from one other redistributor.
How many different blocks do you make? I mean, you're covering small block, LS, Ford.
Yeah, so we've got... So it's not a Chevy block. It's our block, but it's based on a Chevy. So we've got the small block, and we make that both in a what we call a wet, where there's a water jacket all the way around the cylinder, and we make it in a Siamese. So we can make that 4-inch bore up to, we actually go up to 4250 and make a 454 small block. Big blocks, we've got the same. We've got tall deck, short deck, wet, and Siamese. So we go all the way up to 632 cubic inches on a big block. And then we've got Ford Windsor series, the 302 type block and the 351 Windsor block. And we're just, we'll be cutting chips on the LS style block before the end of the year. We have samples in the house. And then we've got another block that we're developing that we try not to talk about development stuff too much because we immediately start getting calls from people wanting to buy it. And we're like a year away from having it.
Yeah. But
we're not done. We want to keep developing products so that we're winding our own watch. And we want to create distance between us and our competitors so that if they want to compete with us, they got to do the same thing.
What's the market like for the 302 or the 351 Windsor and stuff like that? There are people out.
It's got to be all Cobra world, right?
We have a pretty good footprint in the Cobra world. And, you know, I know I've heard of the Ford Coyote. I'm familiar with that. But
how easy it is to install in virtually nothing.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. Here's the challenges with OE stuff. Is 100% guarantee Ford's going to discontinue that. I don't know when, but it will change. And with our product, we don't discontinue it. So if you guys are making a chassis and you're making it fit a certain engine, eventually you got to change it. It's going to fit a different engine. And then what I really think, and honestly, you all would know better than me, but I think our customers, our mutual customers, they want really good technology. And they want it to start and run and perform well. Like I was in a shop a year ago, local car builder shop, does a nice job. Guy buys my engines. And he had a customer there. And his customer was probably the average customer, right? 55 years old, kids are out of college, got enough money to pay somebody to build him a truck. He's building a pickup. I said, what engine are you going to put in it? He said, I'm going to put an LT4 in there. I said, what is an LT4? I don't know, really. It's just a late model engine. It's like, okay, so
Corvette motor.
So my point is, I mean, they want it to start and run. They want it to look modern. So like our Windsor-based engines, I don't know if we'll have it out for SEMA, but we've got small block Chevys, Windsors, and LSs. They all look the same because we have a front-facing throttle. So we've developed our own cast aluminum intake manifolds with a dressy cover that can be changed and somebody's insignia can be put in it. So we're not talking about carburetors and distributors. We're talking about an engine that's got the same electronic controls as an LT4 does or a Ford Coyote, and it starts and runs. It'll start when it's cold. It'll start when it's hot. It doesn't chug when you put it in gear because we go through all that development when we calibrate it. So to me, the bones of the engine, I think, are the least important part. I don't think they want to buy one with a carburetor and a distributor that right. floods, right? I think they want it to start and run and have some modern technology. So I don't worry too much about when the design actually was created. I'm more interested in how can we make this modern? How can we make this look and feel and act like a modern engine?
Well, if
I don't know if anybody will buy it, but that's what I think.
I think that's great. I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about what the customer actually wants, right? The reason they go LS, LT, sometimes Coyote, because that's what's in there. It does all those things really well. If you're making those motors with a front facing throttle body, depending, regardless if it's 350 Chevy or why do all the different motors, and why not just do the one motor? Why does somebody, if they all look the same, why would somebody say, I've got to have a 351 Windsor?
Paint one orange, paint one blue, and you're good to go.
Why does he have, you know what I'm saying? Because the guys don't know.
They want the headaches
you're right.
of dealing with the Ford, the oil pan, and where it's not going
to
fit.
I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. And I would tell you that when we made the molds for the 351 Windsor, we made them adaptable to put a Chevrolet bell housing on it. I don't know who will ever want that, but we can make it a Chevy engine if we wanted to, or a Chevy-style engine. But I think there's still some connection to, I'm a Ford guy, I'm a Chevy guy.
Ford and a Ford.
Yeah, the Ford and Chevy thing you're always going to have, but when you're modernizing something and you take the small block Chevy, which there's nothing wrong with the small block Chevy, but if you update that and now it's like coil-on plug, it's fuel-injected, all modern internals, like where is the divide between that and an LS based motor? Yeah, it's essentially got 8 pistons in it, a crankshaft, a center, a cam goes right down the middle of it. You know, what are the design challenges? What's better about that LS architecture then?
Well, I would think the LS architecture is better. LS, for one thing, it cools a lot better than a small block Chevy. And the port layout where it doesn't have the center two exhaust ports side by side is an advantage. So the LS is, I think, a better platform. From a we still have customers that are cost conscious, and the cost to build an LS is higher for us than the cost to build a small block Chevy type engine. And at the end of the day, we still build some things that nobody buys. So maybe we'll find that out. Maybe we'll find out nobody wants a front. If they want front-facing throttle, they're just going to buy an LS. Could be. But in the meantime, we'll take a stab at it.
Right, right. Back on, not to go back there again, but I'm going back there again. When you're doing 100 engines a day, you're doing through those. Did you ever have, because you were doing it so long and do it so many, have your engines come back through?
I'm sure we did.
I wonder if you I'm sure did or how you could.
In a good way, you're saying?
Come back as a core.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you got to.
Remand or remanded.
Not one that came back.
No, not one that came back from the thing. But because you're going through them so many, I mean, I'm sure you're doing it for years. I mean, those guys, you know, wreck the truck, wreck the car, do something like that, and you get it. And, you know, that guy on the line's looking, he's like, I'm pretty sure that's one of
been
ours.
Been here before.
Yeah. There's my little stamp on the backside.
That probably did happen.
That's crazy. So, SEMA, Board of Directors.
Yep.
Another one of those, what am I going to do next? I'm kind of bored. Let me just go find something to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I have typically throughout my career served on some kind of volunteer board capacity. And whether that was Engine Builders Association, or I did 9 years on a state commission appointed by the governor to the Game and Parks Commission in Nebraska, where we set the park permit fees and the regulations and the hunting seasons and all that. I did that. So I got all done with all that, and I wasn't serving. And a friend of mine suggested that I run for the SEMA board. And I love SEMA. I'm impressed with what they do. I love the show. I'm impressed with the SEMA education. But other than going to the show, I really hadn't been very involved. So I thought, I don't know that anybody knows me enough to vote for me. And he said, nah, you know, you should try it. So I ran for the SEMA board last year, last spring of 2022, and put out the typical SEMA campaign where you have a website and you make a few videos and tell people what you're going to do. And I got voted in. So I'm on the SEMA board, which is cool. And when I ran, I said the thing that I want to focus on is the political part and regulations. They kind of happy to have me do that. I don't think everybody wants to do it. But that's what I'm interested in, and that's where I spend my time.
Made any headway there?
I think we've made a lot of headway, and I think we really suck at telling our story because they really are doing a lot of good. And I got to point out that the same time I got on the board, SEMA hired the head person in their Washington, D.C. office. Their previously head of the D.C. office had passed away several years ago, and they had never replaced him. So there's a lot going on right now. But I get a report from the D.C. office on what they're working on and what they got done. Federally, things are tough. But even on the state level, they do a lot of good. I think it was in Kentucky, where the state legislature wanted to pass a law that said it would be illegal to change your exhaust system from an OEM exhaust system. And the SEMA people got involved and said, I think what you really want to control is how loud it is, right? So let's help you write a noise law. And I think they've used that now in Kentucky and in Hawaii, where both of them wanted to outlaw aftermarket exhaust systems. Man. So I think they do a lot of good, and I think there's a lot more good.
You opened up a can of worms. We're going to get into
first,
the SEMA
first,
deal.
I gotta
That's a meat in the middle.
You're talking about Kentucky, and you're talking politics. My brother-in-law is the right-hand man to the governor over there, so if I need to whoop some ass at Thanksgiving dinner, you let me know. I might be able to make something happen there. You know?
Yeah. Isn't like the state noise of Kentucky straight pipes?
Probably.
I think so.
Probably. I don't know. I gave a report on it a few months ago to some SEMA people, and it was like 2 pages long of all the things they've gotten done in states, and it was really good.
Well, you said that you really suck at telling the story. SEMA, so we love SEMA, first of all. We've had Mike Spagnuolo on.
Yep.
We've had Tommy Gattuso on. We've had RJ DeVera on. We've had a lot of folks from SEMA. SEMA's been pivotal in all of our careers.
They've been great.
So, but you say it's difficult to tell that story specifically when it comes to government regulations and all the good SEMA's doing. So, 5 years ago, there was 25 emails a day from SEMA about the new tag law in Massachusetts that now allows you to put a car in the bottom corner, and then the new Hawaii law that allows you to have headlights above 28 inches, and the new so-and-so, and nobody read that because it was overload of information. Right?
Yeah.
And that was the biggest complaint SEMA always got, was how many emails you're sending. We don't even look at the emails. You bury that information in there, we don't look at the emails. So they've backed off on those emails, and it's been SEMA show, SEMA show, SEMA show. So there's got to be a happy medium. There's also got to be a way of doing it regionally, where that if you're a member company in Illinois and Illinois is passing, you know, whatever that's affecting Illinois residents, send those emails to those Illinois member companies.
Right.
The California company maybe doesn't have to know about, you know, the seatbelt law that's changing in Illinois. So just a suggestion, but I think they've gone so far the opposite way, which I'm glad to not get those emails anymore. But
you're not excited that Rhode Island now has a blue license plate, or?
No, I think there's so many, specifically our customers, shops, big shops, small shops, guys just getting started, guys that are just super interested in the industry, that is buying that spec Camaro chassis and buying a motor from you, that him and his son is doing it in their garage,
right?
That is interested in the industry, right? And they're consuming information at a way different rate than we're consuming it, because we've all been in it too long. We're all jaded. We all have friends. We hear about it through the grapevine. They're consuming it on a different level. So I think there's got to be a way to let those guys know what good SEMA actually is doing, because there's so many guys out there, like you said, that it's a show to them. It's that show, that it's, big show that every year.
It's a show. It is absolutely a show. And thank goodness, Tom Gattuso is awesome. And I would tell you, kind of like, nobody screws with Tom. It's amazing to me that coming into it from the outside, the show's fantastic. And we have all these other things we do. Some of them are big and some of them are little. But those are the only things we ever talk about in the board meetings, right? I can't go into details because I'm like sworn to secrecy. You can't talk about what you talk about in the board. But when it comes to the show, Tom gives his report and we give him the thumbs up and away we go. We leave that show alone, and I think that's awesome. You know, Tom's been there a while. Show's awesome. You've met RJ, mm-hmm. marketing guy. He hasn't been there very long. Mm-hmm. Mike Spagnuolo hasn't been in charge very long. So everything you're talking about, I could only hope that we just get better at it in that communication part. I think there's a lot of branches of SEMA fighting for each one of them want to send out their emails, and there maybe hasn't been a centralized point where it's like, okay, we get it. That's important to what your department does, but overall, this is the message we want to give to our customers. So I hope we get better at it, because I think we're doing a lot of good.
Is there a secret handshake?
There is a secret handshake, but I can't show it to you.
Because it's a secret.
Someone's got to develop the SEMA algorithm so it kind of fits your filter to your needs, like your Facebook or Instagram feed.
Yeah. I think you could just buy that now. You just, like, call up Facebook. Hey, I want one algorithm, please. A medium-sized algorithm.
How about the important stuff? You know, to us, it's we're constantly inquiring about the CARB certification stuff. You know, where do these crate motors and aftermarket motors, where does it all stand from an emissions standpoint? What's the future look like for all that? Is it doom and gloom? Is the future bright?
I think the future's pretty good. So here's one of the things that SEMA's done that I don't know that everybody's aware of, but SEMA now offers what's called SEMA Certified, 49-state program. So with some guidance from the EPA, SEMA has determined that if you can demonstrate that your engine doesn't make the emissions worse than the factory engine, it's probably going to be accepted by the EPA. It won't be accepted by California.
Right.
So we have they just started this program last year, where they'll do testing, or they used to do all this testing and then submit it to CARB and hope CARB would go along with it. But they've realized that even if CARB doesn't accept it, if it's cleaner than the original, EPA will. Mm-hmm. So they organize this program, SEMA Certified. We have the very first certificate for SEMA Certified on a Blueprint 383 engine that's a stroker motor. It's got high-performance heads on it. It's R38350. I don't remember how much money or how much horsepower it makes, but it's a nice motor, and it's considered legal in 49 states. So we wouldn't have that if it wasn't for SEMA. Now, you see, if you look around, I think even if you look at the Ford website, Ford Performance, they have some language like that, but they're just kind of doing it on their own and guessing and hoping. not saying they're wrong, but most of us wouldn't have the courage to say my engine is 49 state legal without SEMA backing it up, saying, yeah, we did the testing, it passed, it's good.
What are they using as the benchmark for, like, a small block? Is it a...
So it becomes...
1950s?
Right, so you're... I sell engines mostly that are not make, model, year related. It's a 383 small block Chevy type engine. Put it wherever you want. When we do that kind of program, we have to make it make, model, year. So we say this is legal to install in this 1971 through 1996, I think our certification is for. And then we list all those vehicles, all the trucks, all the, it's everywhere a small block Chevy was, it's legal. Okay. But it is a time period. You can't put it in a 2018 Corvette, which you wouldn't want to anyway. But at least it gives our customers an opportunity to do it right. Now, that particular engine, we also have a CARB executive order on. But if we didn't, we still would have been able to get 49 state legal. So it's actually 50 state legal.
Let me ask you what you're going to know this on both sides from the engine manufacturer and SEMA standpoint. Low Volume Production Vehicle Act. Awesome. What is a guy's option out there right now, motor-wise, that's going to satisfy CARB and NHTSA for that engine requirements?
Rubber band, probably.
No, we have it. We're working with a major OEM. So the Small Volume Act that was passed in 2015 has some really weird language in it. We're lucky that we have it, but... You know,
it's extremely weird language. You can get into the weeds. Explain the language of it.
It says that the engine has to come from a certified late model, current model year vehicle. Current
model year, right.
Current model year vehicle. So passenger cars and light trucks, the engines are not certified. The vehicle is certified, okay? We do other programs where we certify the engine. But in a car... The whole vehicle certified. So the small volume language says the engine has to come from a certified current model year vehicle. So that means it has to be out of a 2023 or a 2024, right? So we were, of course, we wanted to build engines for this program, but we don't make cars. And we really went round and round trying to figure out how could we certify a car? Can we put our engine in somebody else's car and certify it and then make that legal to sell? And we looked at that, but it wasn't viable. So we went shopping, and last year at SEMA, we announced that we would have an engine, and we're working on that now. We've got the relationship with the OEM. It's coming out of a 2024 pickup, and we wanted to use a pickup engine because we want the heaviest vehicle we can because that's considered the dirtiest. That engine is currently installed in a test rig in California. And we headed to the lab. There still is some work that has to be done to get it legal for SPMV. But the main hurdle that it came out of a 2024 vehicle is done.
And so, that is including the EVAP and the exhaust and CATS and everything out of that current model year, right?
Yep.
So you got to utilize that system.
That is correct.
Okay.
And I think you're right on the EVAP. I'm not familiar with that. But so we have that engine. We've talked to, you know, there's a lot of known suspects in that world that are going to make Mustangs and Broncos and Cobras and those kind of things. And I hope if you're one of those guys and you've talked to us, we've been talking to you every month for the last 3 or 4 months that we're coming with that product. We expect to have it somewhere around the beginning of the year. So, and I think you guys are building chassis for some of them.
Are you the only one out there doing it?
As far as I know, yes.
If we could get, like, the oil pan dimensions or a scan on that so we're ahead of the game so we know it fits and we're ready to roll, that would be beneficial.
We have the 3D models.
Okay.
The oil pan, I don't think, is considered part of the emissions control package, so there's opportunity to change it. We're trying not to change anything that's emissions-related because as we've been walking this through CARB, and I'm not the one doing it. I got people way smarter than me doing this. But as we've been walking this project through CARB in California, it's been challenging for them to understand what they agreed to do and what the law says they'll do. And so we're trying to make it as easy as possible the first time through. Eventually, you know, we'll probably change the exhaust system or maybe we'll change the intake system, go back and do testing. But right now, we're just trying to get them to accept the engine that came from the OEM that way.
Well, that's doing a great service for our industry there, because that that opens up some.
There's some awesome companies, stores there. And I know who they are. I visited them. There's some awesome companies that are doing pretty good volume on, you know, what they call restoration, but it's mostly a new vehicle today.
Sure.
Right.
And they've already have the capacity to do it. You know, they're not body shops. They're actually factories.
Yep.
And we're excited to work with them.
Let me ask you again, I'm not trying to get too far in the weeds, but this is something that's been so fucking fucked up and vague for literally eight years.
Passionate. I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, yeah, since 2015, I mean, it's been so confusing to everybody that's out there wanting to do it. And what, now that the wording finally came down, it was kind of like, oh, well, that like sucks. Once 2024 model year vehicles are here, right? This has to be done all over again?
I think there's an opportunity to use a certain amount of 2024s in 2025. But yeah, at the end of the day, we got to redo our work every time the vehicle changes. Now, if the vehicle emissions don't change, it's just paperwork. We don't have to do new testing.
So I was going to ask, if you have like a new Chevy pickup that's got a 10-year run of the same truck, can you just continue to use that, or do you have to redo it every year?
At the risk of not knowing enough about what I'm talking about, I think we can just submit paperwork and get it recertified under our name. If something changed that affected the emissions, then I think we would need to do testing again.
And are you held on running the exact same exhaust, air intake, tailpipe length, everything?
No, I don't think it's tailpipe length, but I do think from the exhaust through the end of the cat is going to be our first go around that. We will have chassis builders changing their chassis so that it will fit.
We do it all the time, every time.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to avoid. But it's like the worst of evils. It's like us try to change it a lot and have carb turn us down.
Or nobody have a motor out there.
Yeah, versus change around it to package it.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
That's wild. And I'd have thought, you know, to get things certified in California, I figured you know, clip the oil pickup tube off of it and just say it identifies as something other than a motor and you're good to go. You know, I mean,
it identifies as an EV. Yeah. It's got a battery. What is your dealing with DC, dealing with all of the doom and gloom, and everyone's like, I mean, you're not going to take my motors. What do you think the actuality, what's some of the truth behind where we're going to be at with ICE motors in 5 years and 20 years?
I'll give you the bad part first. On April 12th, the EPA issued proposed regulations that would tighten up the fleet standard for emissions. And a fleet standard is the average of what GM sells, or the average of what Ford sells. And it tightened up the emissions so much that by 2032, I think it is, 66% of all passenger cars and light trucks would have to be EVs to meet it that are being sold, right? It's not retroactive yet, but it's being sold. And the truth of the matter is, even though they proposed those regulations and they've gone through the comment period, got a lot of negative comments, a lot of positive comments, they are, I think, ingrained now, and they're the regulations. So that's what the automakers have for regulations. The trouble is nobody can do it, right? There's not enough battery infrastructure. There's not enough electrical infrastructure. The consumer has not made the decision that he wants to buy that. So behind the scenes, I think the car companies, and I'm not very privy to car company thinking, but I think they figure this will probably go away because it's like impossible. So I've worked with my congresspeople. There's been bills passed to take the authority away from the EPA or to nullify this, but because of the makeup of who's in D.C., they can't get it done. So right now it stands that they have to start working down their emissions output, and basically we're going to run out of ICE engines. Now, the reality is that's not even the right solution. If you look at what Toyota talks about, which Toyota's got really good engineering, they're not a bunch of dumb shits. Toyota says EVs are not the answer. Hybrids are a lot better answer. And Toyota gets slammed pretty hard on the global stage of the Green Initiative because they don't support a landslide to EVs. But you can look at a website, the Toyota website, I think even explains it, but it's like for every EV that you make, you could have made 15 or 20 plug-in hybrids with the same amount of content that goes into the battery. And then the other thing that happened on April 12th with the proposal, since the early, I think 2012, the EP had a mandate that when they considered the emissions of a vehicle, they had to consider it cradle to grave. What did it take to make the vehicle? And what did it take to drive the vehicle? All of it. They had suspended that every year since 2012. In April, they permanently removed it.
Of course they did. And it changes.
And you don't have to, there's nobody even disputes the idea that if you look at what it takes to make cradle to grave, most of these EVs are not cleaner than ICE vehicles until maybe you get 80 or 90,000 miles on a car. And on a pickup, it might take 150,000 miles before it's actually cleaner than an ICE vehicle. Hmm. And nobody's talking about, what about the environmental impact of getting all these minerals out of the ground, which, trust me, if we had to get those battery minerals in the United States, we would never do it, right? Because it's dirty, it hurts the environment. But it's fine if it's somewhere else. We can turn a blind eye.
Yep.
So I don't think it's realistic. And then the other thing that I find really amazing is at the same time the EPA is trying to kind of like outlaw ICE engines, another federal agency called the Department of Energy is handing out money to study hydrogen, renewables, renewable natural gas, all these alternative fuels, which really hold great promise. So I think they just are way ahead of themselves. I think if you believe carbon is an issue and you want to solve carbon and lower it, there's lots of great solutions. The EV is really not the most intelligent solution. There are better ways to do it. So this year at SEMA, last year we had a section dedicated to EVs, right? SEMA is about cars.
Yep.
They don't want to pick a lane. We should not pick a lane. We just like cars. We like car people. Whatever the car is, it's fine. This year we're going to add to that, and we're going to have alternative
Except
fuels.
Except those lifted trucks outside.
Yeah, I hate trucks.
Yeah, we
square body those. Trucks should not be part of the industry. No, I love it all. I love it all. So this year there'll be a whole section of the show that's about alternative fuels, whether it's hydrogen or propane or renewables like ethanol.
So they're expanding on that beyond.
They want to open up the discussion.
Last
year
it was just EV. It was an EV section.
And I think it'll help. Everybody can get smarter about what's really going on and what's available and how's it work and. What's the window on getting clean hydrogen? Because hydrogen, you got water dribbling out your exhaust pipe. It's awesome.
Yep.
So I think to accept EVs is to, as the only solution, is to be really not very curious about everything else that's happening. So it's probably, like a lot of things, all of the above is a better solution than just picking one.
Sure.
But in particular, personally, I'm not a fan of the government picking one. I think you guys should pick one, and I should pick one, and we should pick what we want.
Let the market decide.
Yeah.
I mean, the government generally does a pretty good job with the decision-making process, right? I'll tell you, I love electric for my leaf blower. I got a DeWalt leaf blower. It's the best thing to convert to electric. Beyond that...
If you like an electric leaf blower, you should get an electric car.
Beyond that, not a fan, but the hydrogen thing's interesting.
Two-stroker. Nothing.
What does that look like? I mean, you don't hear a lot about it because when you start talking about the environmental impacts, it's just instantly it's either internal combustion or it's electric. Those are your only options.
Well, I'm no expert on hydrogen, but my understanding is the problem with hydrogen burns clean in the engine. Or you could have a hydrogen fuel cell, which I have no idea how that works. But you can use hydrogen and it's perfectly clean. The dirty part about hydrogen is making it. And because typically it's made with electricity, so where did electricity come from? Which is really no different than the question for an EV, right? Where did electricity come from? But I know there's a lot of work being done to figure out how to make clean hydrogen, which the product's all the same. It's just where did the energy come from to make this stuff? And I think hydrogen is probably a really good answer. And again, I look at a company with leadership like Toyota, they think hydrogen's a really good answer. They've got hydrogen products in the pipe. So I think hydrogen's pretty good. In other marketplaces, we've been exposed to what's called renewable natural gas, which is cleaner than clean, It comes off of landfills, and it's gas. It's made from a waste product, and then it's, I think, almost perfectly clean when you burn it on the highway.
Yep.
So there's lots of great answers.
I wonder what happened with that, because that, I mean, the natural gas, that was a little bit of a push, and you saw, like,
all the buses. And
yeah, you started seeing it with cabs, buses, cabs, you know, some delivery vehicles, and then it just kind of, like, fell by the wayside.
Yeah, I don't have that expertise. I'd be making up an answer, and I'm trying to wait until the
somebody's
third drink
uncle
to do
owned
that.
A battery company.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, that's it.
Huh. That's crazy.
It is.
You do think about how many of those buses downtown or whatever you used to see with, you know, that and propane, too.
Yeah.
The
propane's really good. I know at the show this year, they're going to have some kind of panel discussion, and they've got experts from all of those different fields, propane, hydrogen, whatever, and everybody can kind of talk about what their stuff is good at. And I think there's some kind of synthetic propane that is, like, 100% clean. So there's, again, it's way too early to pick a winner of replacement. So I was telling my sales guy, Kel, today, I read on the internet, which is a great source for all information, but I don't think this is, this is not new news, but I don't think everybody knows it. But there's like 17 states that said, if California eliminates ICE engines, we're going to eliminate ICE engines. 17 states pledged to follow California. So I know that's one of the things that SEMA's doing, not because we think EVs are bad, but because we don't think the state should be the one deciding, right? But Dodge, or Stellantis, as it's known today, has come out and said that they won't put anything on the dealer lots in those states that's not a plug-in hybrid. You cannot buy a pure ICE vehicle starting in January from Stellantis in those 17 states.
That's bending.
I don't know why they're doing that, but I mean, it's like, really? My choices are already limited, and they haven't even enacted laws yet just because they said they were going to? That's crazy.
It's like smuggling cars into new states.
I mean, they're doing away
with
this.
Yeah, I think it said you can order them, right? So this is Stellantis doing this. It's not the state doing it. So you can order an ICE vehicle, but
there's just nothing in stock that you can walk in and
they're not
a dealer.
They're not going to put them in stock. And I think we'll see a lot of those 17 states go away and say, now that we're serious about it, we don't want to do that.
Hmm. Yeah, they're wild times. You know, I wonder, all this talk about the electric stuff, you know, what's behind the scenes on it? You know, where's the funding coming from when you see all these companies moving towards it, that knowingly that it's not any better from an emissions standpoint? And like you said, I mean, 80,000-90,000 miles beyond that before it actually
helps. And it doesn't help very much.
And nowadays, what makes it to that? I mean, the days of, aside from the couple of dually trucks that we've ran for too long that are, you know, coming apart, that got 120,000-150,000 on them, most people don't maintain or keep vehicles for that length of time anymore. It's just not like that anymore.
Think about how much stupider people are going to be, though, if they only were driving EV cars for the next 20 years. They don't ever have to do anything. No thinking for themselves whatsoever. I'm not saying if it was the only option, people will take for granted the things you have to do in a normal car. The way we grew up, the things you have to do with driving a vehicle, putting gas in it.
Yeah,
me and him, we have to put gas in our vehicles, right?
I eventually, when it runs out.
When it gets on E, you have to find a gas station and put gas in your vehicles. So you run into the nicest people.
Dude, I don't know. Stations. I mean, you want to talk, like, you could say that. That's a great argument, right? But I grew up and with my mom and dad driving a late 80s Corvette. Dad probably had a couple cocktails. Both of them are smoking cigarettes. I'm sitting in the back, you know, under that little convertible top area, that little well back there.
It's not a seat.
Maybe not. Maybe they're not getting stupider. You know, today it's like, you like to think, we're talking about like nostalgia. Yeah, it was cool. Like, back in the day.
This comes from a guy with an electric leaf blower, though. I can't listen to anything. Do they make electric backpack leaf blowers?
I don't know. I've just got the little one. I live in the woods, man. I don't want to have to tell that's what she uses. I don't want to have to field the phone call to tell her how to, like, pre-mix the gas or change the spark plug. It's plug the fucking battery in. blow the shit off the deck.
A couple pumps on the bubble, one pull. When it hits, turn that choke off.
Yeah, I walked through your manufacturing plant, and I saw a lot of what you do to make it hard to do it wrong. You mistake proof or poke yoke, and you've got processes and the way you put the little tabs in and all that so that it's harder to do it wrong.
Yep.
I bought an electric chargeable weed whacker because of that, because I'm not the one running it, right? And especially at work, I might have anybody that's get that weed whacker and go clean that up. And it's like, yeah, the two-stroke deal is you got to be half mechanic.
That's a fouled plug for a newbie every time.
Oh, yeah. So it's like, I don't want that call saying, it won't start. Okay, well, I'm working in the business. I'm in a meeting. I can't go start the damn weed whacker.
Yeah.
So I did it. I thought it was all right.
There's a time and a place for it. I mean, out of convenience, it has its place. If we're talking emissions, like, let's be truthful about it, you know? If we want to sell it just like sheerly out of convenience that, hey, guess what? You don't have to change the oil. There's minimal maintenance. Yeah, it's going to, you know, there's people digging holes in, you know, Africa and child labor, and it's, you know, polluting the hell out of the environment. But hell, you know, you don't have to take the damn car and change the oil. It's great. Let's just be honest about it, you know?
I think that's 50-50 all. 50-50 there. Never change the oil.
I'm driving it.
I really think that's all it takes is for everybody to actually have the whole story and all the information. I trust people typically to make good decisions if they know everything about it. And I've pushed, and I haven't had to push very hard because it's been very well received, but pushed SEMA to say, hey, we need to tell this story at this show. And there's a group of us that have got on board and helped find the right speakers and get that forum set up and get the right presenters and get the right folks on display to tell that story so people understand.
Right.
Here's what's really going on. Here's our choices.
Yeah.
You I trust make, you to make a decision.
Of you got to make sure that the people continue to want that story, because the story is a little longer sometimes. To know the whole story, in essence, the definition of it, it's a longer story than what you've been told before. Nobody wants anything that's a longer story. Everybody wants something that's quick, short.
Bullet points.
Want the 10 seconds on TikTok. Just, I mean, how many people, I mean, I deal with it, people all the time. You know what? Just tell me what I should get. Just tell me what I should get.
Blueprint.
Just tell me what car I should
get. A
Roadster shop chassis.
I listened to
the testimony of the public when the EPA was taking in public testimony on their new regulations. And the short and sweet ones were the people, and a lot of them were family people, moms and dads, saying, I have kids and I'm for clean air, so I'm in favor. That was it.
Yeah.
It was like, I don't think you really understand what you just said.
There's more to this. They don't want to be bothered with it.
Yeah.
They've got.
But I mean, it's compelling. What's that make me? The anti-clean air guy?
Right.
Right.
But I'm for Earth.
Yeah. I think
I'm pro Earth.
Yeah. I think there's more to the story. So.
Yeah. Put the facts out there. Right.
What would you like? You're going to. So you've been on the board, what, a year?
A year and a half? A year.
You got to do 2-year term?
I think.
And then run again? Something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
What would you like to be known for when you're done, your 17 terms or whatever you're going to run?
So if it works out right, there'll be a handful of people that know that I made a significant impact and a whole bunch of people that don't, because I'm not doing it for that. I really just want to help. I mean, I like praise and, you know, people.
Who doesn't?
But that's... those are at odds to seek those things. Right. I'm trying to help. I'm a little more of a smoke-filled backroom kind of guy. And I told them when I ran and when you get interviewed, you know, they got to select you to see if you're even qualified to run. It's like, yeah, I probably won't be the one at all the awards banquets that stands up on a stage and gets all the adulation. But
they don't do that, SEMA, do they?
You know, they might have a little of that. But I mean, anyway, I don't mind that, but that's not why I'm there.
Right.
Right? I will know if I made a difference, and I hope a few other people know, and then that's good enough. That's good enough.
Now let's talk about motors, man.
Motors. Yeah, what are
the most badass motor? You've got a lot of options. What's a guy, because for us, you know, we sell a tremendous amount of chassis, and everybody seems to be wanting more and more horsepower, 50-50 split, naturally aspirated. LT4 is great because it's affordable horsepower, but the horsepower game, I mean, people want more and more power nowadays.
What do they do with that?
Nowadays you can use it. No, I mean, you can use the pipe. And years ago, you'd get some nasty big block and you put it in a stock muscle car. And what do you do with it, right? Unless you're building a dedicated drag car, you couldn't really put it down or make it a functional car. But now you can go get a 650 horsepower LT4 from General Motors and it drives like a Toyota Camry when you want it to. And you put your foot in it and it's an animal.
Yeah.
So what are the options out there? Because for us, it's almost all LS or LT. I mean, a little bit of Coyote stuff, but.
So like before we got here today, we were visiting a friend of ours, your friend and mine, and it's Casey Wagner. And I really get a kick out of what he does. He's on a different end of the spectrum than what we are. Casey builds a lot of really special one-off stuff that is absolutely fantastic. We're more of a cookie cutter approach. So our higher end products and our exciting things would be our supercharged products. Could be a supercharged Hemi, supercharged LS.
Sure.
We don't have a supercharged big block, but we have a 1,015 horsepower 632 that, and we're adding more and more fuel injection and things like that. You know, a lot of our base engines in the $4,000 or $5,000 range are carbureted, and I don't even like them.
Yeah.
I think fuel injection is awesome, and we work with all the major fuel injection suppliers, and we also create some of our own systems using some OEM components and ECMs, and I like that a lot. And again, my focus, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, but we have an argument at work, and that is in the performance aftermarket, everybody's got these ECMs that you can plug something into and dick with them.
Yep.
And I don't want that. And I tell my guys, hey, we're not making racing engines. We're not trying to tune this at the dry lakes. I think our customers just want to turn the key and have it work every time.
Sure.
And so we're going to lean more that direction towards locked up, closed up ECMs. And we'll probably offer both in case I'm wrong, because the other stuff we can buy, the locked up one we have to develop. But I think, 800 horsepower is really cool. I think with we're going to be launching a new LS type engine that is based on our version of an iron block, which we know that we can have some production versions of that well into that 1,200-1,300 horsepower.
6.2 based?
Yes. Yep. So like the LS block, it took us 4 months to design it. We look at everything that's out there in the marketplace to understand the features. Who's got what? This got 6 head bolts. These have 4 head bolts. What do we want to offer, you know? What about piston cooling? How do we want to accommodate piston? Want to do it the way the factory did, or want to do something different? What's the deck heights need to be? What are people really using, and what do they want to buy, right? Because we don't want to make this Frankenstein thing that can do everything, because you'll never even build it that way. You'll build a couple configurations. So our LS block will easily go to, I think, about 440 cubic inches, maybe bigger than that. We do have a tall deck version of it. And being iron, you can make a lot of power really reliably, and we can put a supercharger on that. Love superchargers. Magnuson and Whipple, we use both of those, and it's an easy way to get a lot of power. And people want bragging rights, we can check that box and give them bragging rights. And we can build that same, you know, the difference between us and Casey's, we really just want to build the same engine over and over. If our customer wants to customize it, he can. But what he gets for that is it's going to be a lot less expensive than a custom engine. So it's not for everybody. It is a little bit cookie cutter, but because we build that same product over and over, we have a lot of cost advantage.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's a great recipe. Like, our spec chassis lineup has quickly grown to be our most popular. It's, you know, not to say it's cookie cutter, but it's very engineered based. It's a little more budget than our higher end stuff. And the majority of those, they're guys that are putting like a 430, 480 horse LS3, and it's a little bit of a budget focus here and there.
Yeah.
And there's obviously guys doing all sorts of wild stuff with them, but that's where that motor package is a home run. You know, finding something that it's plug and play, it's easy to install, budget minded, and functions.
Yeah.
Is a home run.
That's what I think too. And yet I know people love horsepower, and that's so easy to make today with the products that are available that we can put on there with a supercharger. It's like, that's a nothing burger. It just makes it more fun, right?
Yep.
So you probably have insane advantage on the reliability and just doing the same thing over and over again, so it's not a guess if these pistons and these valves are going to work with this combination with this head. That's kind of our hang up a little bit on the, you know, every motor being a custom one-off. You kind of don't know what it's going to do until it's in the car and down the road.
Yeah.
Versus having kind of a proven, reliable platform that you can kind of sell over and over again and then let the customer, you know, customize with their valve covers and their air cleaner and paint to match, whatever.
Yep. You're exactly right. And we've vet those combinations quite a bit. You know, it'll take us a while to develop a brand new engine. And especially if it's going to be fuel injected and we use our own type of system, we'll put it in a vehicle and drive it. And we'll drive it high and we'll drive it low and we'll drive it light and we'll drive it heavy. We'll put it in a reefer trailer and freeze it to make sure it'll still start. There's a lot of work goes into it before we release something. And then, yeah, we don't want to change the compression after that. We'd like to keep it the same way.
You put it in a reefer trailer and see if it'll still start.
Got a reefer trailer parked outside the engineering lab.
That's cool.
We took the axles off of it so you can drive it in there.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, we try to, I mean, we're not an OEM. We're not Ford and GM, right? They put 10 million hours in calibrating an ECM. But we'll put 4 months in it, and it'll be pretty dedicated, and we're having a pretty good idea that everything's going to work. Because we don't know where the engine's going, right? Is it going to be in a light car or a heavy car? It needs to work in both places, automatic, stick shift, whatever. It needs to work.
Yep.
So we'll do that, and we still can support it. If you have a problem, we're going to support it. I mean, our customer service program is that basically we don't have unhappy customers.
Are you only in automotive, or are you doing anything industrial, marine, or anything like that?
We do industrial. So we take those same platforms, that same 350 Chevy type engine, and we make an industrial engine out of it. And we take the big block engines and we make industrial engines. Today, most of those industrial engines end up in generators. So some of the world's largest generator manufacturers buy engines from us for their spark ignited. Like when you're in the industrial world, you learn new words. They don't call it gas and diesel. They call it spark ignited or compression ignited. So we're in the spark ignited world. And in a power gen application, that means natural gas or propane. And typically those are 100% EPA certified. We have our own lab and we pull our own emissions data and we do calibrations to meet those emissions. We get those engines certified. And so in the other difference in the industrial division, we use liters. But in Blueprint, we use cubic inches. So our our 632 Blueprint is a 10.3 liter in an industrial application.
Man, so I've got an asshole for a neighbor, so I need a 632 generator. I want like a 12-to-1 compression.
Straight pipe.
Can we do that? Can we put something like that together? Yeah, I want that thing just cackling. Maybe we can run it on alcohol. I don't know.
Just something nasty.
Power's out again. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's for charging your EV.
You're going to run
that thing all day long.
You know, that's really true. We have generator customers or prospects, people that are dreamers that have ideas. For example, I have a genset customer that has an idea about loading up several of my 9-liter engines.
Of course he does.
Several of my 9-liter engines in a semi-trailer with generators. And I don't know if he wants to sell them to the U.S. government, but he has this vision of a hurricane coming to Florida, and all the lanes are headed north out of Florida, and all the EVs run out of juice about 3 hours in.
Okay.
And there's a lot of people we talk to about charging EVs with our engines.
Well, that is
especially
crazy.
In emergency situations, right? Because you can't get those EVs out of Florida if you've got a big enough hurricane.
It's brilliant, but the irony of that is
phenomenal.
It's wild.
Put a trailer hitch on one. Put a trailer hitch on a Tesla. The big enough generator, run forever.
That's a dean right there.
So forever. You know, for the last 3 or 4 years, there's been all this talk about EVs, right? And I kept thinking that the people that make electricity have to be part of this discussion, and there must be an overall plan. And I got a hold of our power company in Nebraska, and I got a hold of some of the executives, and it's Nebraska, but they serve on boards for power companies all over the country, sure. right? They go to conventions. They know what's going on. And I said, so what's the plan? He said, there's no plan. I said, so we're going to increase the demand for electricity, and we have no plan to increase the amount of electricity we make. Nope. He said, as a matter of fact, it's going the other way. He said, as we get rid of coal and natural gas-fired electrical plants and run it on wind and solar, he said, the grid will never be as reliable as what it was 10 years ago. There's going to be a great unreliability to the electric grid. Well, that's what my generator customers see. So
sure.
the industrial side of the business is booming because they see all this instability in the electrical grid and know that they have an opportunity to fill gaps.
But any of those people that are in the know that are doing making it, they don't. It doesn't really matter, but because all of this is just cool things to say now for the election.
The facts.
It's just to show that you're going one direction or another. They don't care what the face of the planet looks like in 10 years.
That doesn't say very much about the voting public, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Sure doesn't.
Pretty shallow knowledge base there.
Well, again, back to the other statement. They don't want the full story. It's just kind of like, tell me who to vote for. I'm going to follow these people on Instagram and Facebook, and so-and-so says that she follows him, so go that guy.
Here's the story, though. I mean, here's facts, right? These are facts.
100%.
Right? There's a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure plan? Well, that's the fact. Those are the facts right there.
Yeah.
This shit doesn't work. It's not going to work.
Yeah, it's not going to work. When the EPA issued those proposed regulations, I got a hold of one of my U.S. senators, which is easy to do in Nebraska. There's only like 2 million people in Nebraska, right? So everybody knows everybody. So I called the senator, Pete Ricketts, and I said, Pete, what's going to happen with this? Is this real? And he said, it's bullshit. They're not going to do it. Okay.
Yeah.
That was his take. It's like, this probably will never happen. So I think that's really the truth.
Sure.
And I bet it would scare us to know who at the EPA is making these things up and how smart they are and probably how young they are. If you go to Washington, D.C., you kind of realize that a lot of the folks running that place are about 23 years old.
Yeah.
Very, very idealistic, not a lot of life experience. And it's an awesome gig, but
they got some pronouns.
Yeah, they got some pronouns.
They've also probably never been in like a muscle car with an RS chassis, blueprint 700 horsepower LS. No. That might change some opinions.
They would
maybe
not.
Maybe a demo. Hey, maybe
they would not be in one.
Maybe a demo car, but you force them into
the
one.
The DC right? demo car.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll change some opinions for sure.
Do you find it all, I don't know, insulting is the right word, but just with how efficient and how much horsepower can currently be made on gas-powered motors? Like, we're at, like, the absolute peak right now, and they're almost, like, taking the legs out from underneath you on all the legislation that they're trying to outlaw all that?
No. I'm excited about the future of the industry. I really am. I think maybe I'm naive or maybe I'm just optimistic. But, you know, when I started in this as a teenager, I drag raced a 1971 Dodge Charger. It was a big old heavy pig. And I had a 440 with a six-pack motor. I built the motor. And that thing, by today's standard, probably makes about the same horsepower as what a 383 that we sell every day makes, yep. right? The availability of the components, the heads, the camshafts, all the good stuff. We used to go to the junkyard looking for stuff, right? Saturday afternoon, you're in the junkyard trying to find some double hump heads or whatever. So the ease that we can make that horsepower, I think, is really cool. And I can sell an engine for a 2015 Camaro that makes 900 horsepower, and it's EPA legal. So I'm good with that. I'm not worried about it.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. Like, we've come so far in making such incredible horsepower easily, cheaply, yeah. and efficiently, right at the time where they're banning all gas-powered motors and trying to eliminate it.
They just say they are. They say they're going to.
Yeah, like Dodge has eliminated all the Hellcats, and was, you know, you walk into a dealer and buy a 7,000-8,000 horsepower Mopar. That's insane that you could do that, and now they're just gone.
That might not be the worst idea either.
Considering this is a podcast, I'm assuming that we don't actually have to be right about everything we say, right?
Yeah. Nobody facts.
I don't know if this is true, but I've been told that some of the Dodge engines or cars that don't have engines in them have a transmission tunnel in case they need to put engines in them.
Yeah. Really?
I don't know about retrofit, but at least Dodge might be saying we're not going to change the die that stamps the floor because we might still need it. I don't know if that's true. I've heard it a couple times. But if nothing else, it's great, a great rumor to spread.
Yeah, it's good.
Even if it's not true. So I think it'd be really hard to be a car company where you've got these regulations that you really don't believe are going to stay in place, and yet you're supposed to figure out what to make.
From a Stellantis and Dodge specifically standpoint, Dodge is like the friend or guy that we all knew in high school that was whichever way the wind blew, right? It was, oh, yeah, I love whatever band. And everybody's, oh, I love. So,
and because then it goes super hard in that direction.
It's super hard. I mean, from a company that was making 1,000 horsepower streetcars to be the first one, it's like, yep, you know what? Pro Earth, all EVs, no ICE. Yeah, you were also selling like the biggest truck with the biggest motor, right? The biggest cars with the biggest motors. Oh, you think 800 is great? What about a 900? I mean, a Jeep Grand Cherokee with 1,000 horsepower, like that. That was well known as the company that's like, fuck it, put a bigger one in it. Yep. Put a bigger one in it.
You get the red eye next, you get the double red eye. Two red eyes.
And then, like a flip of a switch, yeah, you know what? I mean, we've got to start worrying about that. Come on. It seems a little disingenuous from that company specifically to go so hard the other direction. Just my own personal opinion.
I think you're probably right. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but anybody can look them up. If you look at the stock value for Tesla, and what's called the price-earnings ratio. In other words, how much the company is worth and how much money they make and what the value of the stock is. It's astronomically higher ratios than what any of the guys in Detroit are. So if you wonder what GM or Stellantis is trying to do, I think when I looked at it, GM would go from whatever it is, $10 billion in valuation to $400 billion in valuation if they just had the Tesla ratios. And Tesla has those ratios because they're seen as being a super clean company and a leader in the future. And, you know, it just seems obvious to me. They're just chasing the stock value.
Yeah.
They're not trying to change the world.
All of them are dirty.
Trying to get their stock to go up.
You look at GM and Ford, though, I think both of them are like, they're kind of like the players. They're kind of like, yeah, baby. Like, I only have eyes for you, you know, on the ice stuff. Then over here, we're like, oh, yeah, we're going to build this fucking thing. Oh, only this. Yeah, I mean, 750 horsepower, twin turbo, no problem. Oh, I mean, the Mustang Mach-E. Yeah, I mean, we care about the world. Oh, yeah, the GT40. At least.
They're playing in all ponds.
They're playing in all ponds, right? And then Dodge is, like, coming out. Oh, yeah, fuck it. We're going to go all the way this way.
2 feet in either puddle, whatever.
Yeah, 100%. you know, at least try to play all sides, you know what I'm saying?
Yep. Yeah.
Or have, like you said, at the end of the day, it's capitalism. Have options for the public. Let the public decide. If 5 years go down the road and nobody's buying the new C8, Z018, twin-charged, whatever it is, and everybody's buying a Chevy Cruze, then shareholders, you know, have to make a decision and they have to go in a certain direction. But I don't think it's going to happen. Instead of Dodge paying, like, we're going to make the decision for you. Well, they probably realize that all those are piece of shit cars and not going to build them anymore and try something new.
Yeah,
imagine bringing back the Dodge Intrepid that was fully EV or a 300M. What if it was just retro Chrysler products?
Retro 90s?
They repowered
the 300Ms.
Or all the cab forward design stuff from the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough sell, I think.
I think it'd be pretty cool.
There's a market somewhere for it. With all this crazy electric talk and all this, what's the future looking like for Blueprint? I mean, what's on the drawing board? Where are you guys headed? What's next?
So it's mostly engines. I do think, and again, I would defer to you guys. I'd call you guys and ask for your opinion on this. But I think because it's a little bit of a fad and a novelty, there might be an opportunity with some EV conversion stuff. And it's really early on in the marketplace. We go to the SEMA show. You can find people that have EV conversions, or say they do, and so they can make an electric vehicle, into take a 1969 Mustang or whatever. So I think there's probably some opportunity for that. We've looked at it. We really haven't had time to look at it. We've been pretty busy making engines. But I don't want to just stick my head in the sand and say EVs suck, yep. right? It's like, no. What I support is people having customized vehicles, whether that's a brand new car that you put your own sun visor on, or running boards, or a complete build-up with a roadster shop chassis. I think the American people should have the opportunity to customize their vehicle. So anything that happens in that customization realm, I'm in support of, and I think SEMA is too. That's what the industry is about, right? It's a personal vehicle. You should be able to personalize it. So we'll look at EV conversions, and that probably also spills over into our industrial side, where there could be some California mandates to eliminate internal combustion engines on some industrial applications. And rather than throw the whole chassis away, we might have an EV conversion for you there. But otherwise, it's engines. So we did a survey and looked at who our customers are for Blueprint engines. And we found out that like 20 to 35-year-old people, they know who we are and they like us, but they really don't have the money to buy our stuff, right? We don't have, they're the junkyard LS guys, yep. which is awesome. You got to start somewhere. I have no problem with that. And then you get into the older people, but we finally got to like 55 years old before we found the guy that buys most of our engines or buys most of your chassis or your chassis being built for.
Sure.
So it's that guy who's finally got some scratch. He's ready to fulfill his hobby, his lifelong dream. So I look at it like this. When I see kids hot rodding EVs, I know that I have from now until they're 50 years old to still sell engines. Like one of my engineers, Chris, who heads up our engine development department, he came and told me, he said, I was out on the town the other night. He said, I was at this parking lot at this grocery store, and here's all these high school kids with Challengers and Chargers. You know, and they just loving them up. And it's like, those guys are going to be customers of mine. Not even for 20 years they won't be my customer because they won't be able to afford it.
Yep.
But eventually they're going to buy a Hemi from me for their Challenger or Charger that they had when they were in high school or their buddy had.
Yeah.
So I think we got a long runway, and I think it's really foolish to try to plan any further out than that anyway because I can't predict everything. So it's mostly engines. Engines are our future.
Do you see your customer base going more towards a complete ready-to-run package, or are you selling a lot of long blocks?
No, I think we're seeing people want more complete, right? We talked about how when I was a kid, and maybe you guys, you know, I used to go to the junkyard and scrounge around stuff, and you build an engine, and you realize you don't have a bracket to hold the throttle cable, and you make one. Mm-hmm. And today you can buy one, but they don't know which one to buy. We get the calls on our tech lines. Like, well, which throttle bracket should I buy for your engine? It's like, why don't I just put the throttle bracket on it for you, right? Sure. So we're going more that direction to, hey, you know what, we're just trying to solve the customer's problem. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to keep him happy. So we do have certainly a class of customers that want a really complete product that has front drive, has the alternator, power steering, has a transmission, manual or automatic, and it's just a drop-in solution for them. So we're developing more of that all the time. But at the same time, we still have price point buyers that can't afford all that, and they got a pile of parts in the garage, and they're going to finish up our engine with that.
Now, as you're focusing more on the EFI stuff, you look back in the day, you're putting a crate motor in a car. It's a, you know, an HEI distributor. It's a one-wire alternator. Maybe it's a 350 ZZ4 crate motor. You've got essentially like three wires to hook up, power and ground to the distributor, wire to the alternator. On the EFI side, for the guys who are converting, how simple can you make that? Like, will that get to the point where it's literally like, here's power and ground this and send that to 12 volts and you are
absolutely
good to go?
Absolutely, we can get it to that point. And then we can do a lot of monitoring with EFI that we don't, I don't know if it's available or if people just don't use it, but I'd like to make sure that if something goes wrong, the customer can't break the engine or the engine won't break. Like, we can put it in limp mode if it overheats. If you have an oil pressure problem, we can pull the power out of it. We can do a lot of things to make the engine live forever with EFI and that ECM that we can't do with a carburetor and a distributor. So I think those are actually good attributes.
Yeah, great.
Why ruin it when you don't have to? You can go into limp mode if it gets hot. You can cool it down and at least get somewhere instead of ruining the whole engine.
Sure.
Do you have issues with that, with all the different applications that these motors are going in, and you know where O2 sensors are, and
you know we will have to specify where the O2 sensor is and how far it can be from the cylinder head, because that's a major part of the data capture, right? So it maybe takes a little more sophistication on making sure you're doing it right. One of the biggest problems we have with O2 sensors and EFIs is the variety of exhaust gaskets and header flanges that leak, right?
Okay.
We'll get an engine back that wasn't running right, and you'll see the exhaust bloat all over the side of the cylinder head.
Sure.
It's like, this was just an exhaust leak, but the O2 sensor quit working, and it started throwing fuel at it, and it's like, we might need to specify which exhaust gaskets to use, or with our own system, we can limit how far it will adjust. We can say, you can adjust from the O2 reading, you can adjust this far.
X percent of
correction. And that way we know you're never going to go outside into this crazy land that obviously happens when there's an exhaust gasket blown.
Yep.
So we're using technology, again, to try to make the engine more friendly to the customer. He needs to have a good experience, right? This is just for fun. That's why he bought it. It's just for fun. I think there are probably some really great tuners out there, and there are people that are doing competition things that, you know, really know what they're doing. But I think our customers just are trying to start it and go drive it on Saturday and have fun.
A lot of guys don't have access to a phenomenal tuner that they can get a car to and make sure everything's running. So something kind of ready to run out of the box.
Yeah.
It feels like a lot bigger, wider audience.
When you Google tuners, it doesn't say this one's good and this one sucks.
You find that out after.
Yeah, and I don't know which one's
an expensive finding.
I don't know which one's which. Everybody's a tuner, right? I got HP tuners. I'm a tuner. I know all about it. It's like, no, I don't think so.
Yep. How about on the LS stuff, right? The classic look is very popular right now. I'm sure you're in tune with that.
That's crazy.
You can make an LS look like anything you want.
I know.
Now, what prevents a company of your size with the resources that you have from literally making that motor look that way, right? Now, you take a cylinder head that I'm sure you're casting a cylinder head, and you change that footprint to accept a small block Chevy cover. You make your own manifolds. You make your own harness to where that thing is legitimately turnkey because, I mean, in our industry, it's got to be 75% of the damn LS motors.
Really?
Are made to look like
a small, like block, small Chevy. Block Chevy. Yeah. We're getting a stock Chevelle in with an original, you know, 327, and we're saving the valve covers, we're saving the air cleaner, we're saving the distributor, stuff that we normally would have just thrown away to make the 600 horsepower LS look like a worn-out small block.
You know, if there's enough demand for something like that, we'll make it that way.
Yep.
But otherwise, it's mostly external things. So we look at it like, well, we're trying to, you know, we're doing a cookie-cutter deal so our customer can change it. But I find that really intriguing, right? Because the other thing is people tell me, I don't want to buy your engine because it looks like an old engine. I want the plastic engine cover that hides everything that I can't see what's under it. You know, it's like, I don't, sure. Your world is unique. You're probably a little closer to the customer than we are.
Yep.
I remember talking to a friend of mine. You know, we were talking about Cobra cars, kit cars. And he says, I think if I was going to do a kit car, I'd put a Ford Coyote in it. I said, why would you put a Ford Coyote in it instead of my engine? He said, I just like the way they look. And I said, have you ever seen one without the $130 plastic engine cover? And he said, no. And I showed him a picture. He says, that's ugly. I said, so the part you like is this engine cover. And I mean, it's cool if that's what you like, but I can put an engine cover on my engine too. So I don't think those buyers really are about it's a two-valve or a four-valve, or it's an overhead cam, or it's a push rod. They just want a certain look. And you're telling me that 60% of the market right now wants the look of an old school, which is cool. I think that's great.
I think you'll see it bleed over. You know, I think it takes time to hit the mainstream.
Yeah.
So for your customer base, you know, it could be a couple of years, and then they'll get in tune with it. And we see it, too. I'd like some newer customers, some guys that have, you know, had some – the coolest thing they bought for their old car is a Crate 302, and they bought the Ford Motorsports valve covers and, you know, the Holley double pumper, and they bought the Ford air cleaner nut.
You're
and all
talking
that.
About my Bronco, aren't you?
No. But once they see what that look is for that LS motor that's dressed up to look like a small block, all of a sudden that is the coolest thing in the world to them. So there's a little bit of education there, but the look of it's.
See, you're telling me what I need to make, and I'm telling you I'm about to launch a product that has front-facing throttles and engraved top intake manifold. Yeah. It's like that's the opposite, right? My 383 looks like that already.
Yep. Sure.
Make your LS motor look like your 383. Well, just buy the 383.
Well, just forecast now that, you know, a couple, 2-3 years out, and then, he's...
No, it's fine. Those are not derogatory to say at all. Those are fashion trends.
Yep.
Right? So that's what's hot today. Something else will be hot tomorrow.
Of course.
I think we can put the same engine underneath it, and that's the main part that I'm concerned about.
Sure. Yeah.
So.
The guts. It's.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's. But that's building cool. The horsepower, building the reliability, and then you can put whatever valve covers and intake manifold and air cleaner on it.
Yeah.
From there up, that's the. I the saw personalization some, said.
Yeah, I looked at your cars in your showroom, and I see some engines like that, you know, and you see an LS looking old school and painted with Pontiac engine paint blue. It's like, it looks like a Pontiac to me. Yeah. You know? It don't look like a Pontiac at all, but even to me, it looks like a Pontiac.
Sure. So
I get that.
Yeah, it is funny. We were, I was just out at the Triple Crown show, and I had a good friend of mine who lives locally, and he's into cars, but not super knowledgeable on this stuff. So I'm trying to educate him a little bit because he wants to build something. So I'm explaining to him that everything you see, it's the same motor. It's basically an LS3. They're all the same. Like, so it's different valve covers. And also I said, look, for instance, this one. This is an LS3. It's got some, like, 409 valve covers on it. And he says, well, what about this one? And I look over, and it's a 55 Chevy. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's the same. And I look at it. It's a fucking V10 LS motor. Like, what are the odds of, like, here I'm trying to be, like, the guy who knows what the hell he's talking about. I'm like, well, where the hell did that even come from?
That's the same thing. They just put two extra cylinders in the front or back.
Who makes that? I've seen the V12, the Falconer one. Damn, V10 LS motor. Crazy.
That was some weird prototype deal.
Well, it was there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. People like that kind of stuff. I remember talking to some folks in the parts business, and they were saying, you know, yeah, we saw all these crankshafts for 350s and 383s, but people get tired of that. They want something special. And they started offering, like, Model T cranks and Ford V8 cranks and stuff like that, flathead V8, because people want something unique, right? And I suppose that drives your market a little bit at the very high end. Is they don't want the same thing as everybody else has.
As soon as it's available, it's not cool anymore.
Yeah. Are you sure that V10, that wasn't the March?
No, I counted.
Like the accessory that bolts onto the front of it?
I counted.
There was legit. I saw an article on it. It was some GM prototype that they came out with, and they built like two or three of them and never did anything else with it.
Somebody snuck it out the back door.
Yeah.
Must have.
Ford had a V10, Dodge had a V10, so not hard to conceive that GM might have practiced on one.
Yeah.
Well, we do this every podcast. We come to the standard questions that we ask every single guest.
Good.
We're going to do something with these one day, like montage and something, but we keep saying we're going to do that, and we haven't done it.
If we get a break, too.
It's the best
you need to take a break?
No, I'm good.
All right. Your very first car and a story about that car.
1969 Ford F-150 pickup. It started off ugly green, and I rolled it into my dad's barn and used straight enamel and painted it red with yellow flames. Oof. And forever, when I polished it and waxed it, my rag would turn red and yellow.
Did you lay out the flames yourself?
Yeah.
Were they lobster claws? Like, you know.
No.
They were good nice. Licks on them.
There wasn't any fogging or frosting to them. They're just yellow and red. Right? Okay. But, yeah, I could run tape and lay out. I was never a very good body man or paint guy, but I didn't even know what paint to buy, right? I was probably 14 when I did it.
This one's gonna be good because of your current position. Your favorite SEMA story or best SEMA story? We've all got good SEMA stories.
Yeah, Josh is still in the number one spot. So.
I don't know what that is.
A story, something. Yeah, you don't know what that is. You've got to have a something.
Thanks
that
for
happened
the clarification.
At SEMA.
Memorable moment, something.
You know, I do remember at a SEMA show probably 10 years ago. our booth was not very far away from the Roush performance booth, and Jack was there. And Jack and I are not like friends, right? We did not maintain that relationship from the time I was 15. But he was there, and he was there, you know, almost like for signing autographs or something. And I probably stood in line and got to be my turn. And I told him the fastest version of that story I could. And he reached in his pocket and handed me his business card and said, call me. I never did call him because I didn't need anything. But I remember that. And I doubt if he remembers it. But
that's really cool.
That was it was kind of fun because he was, I used to kind of be a Ford guy, and he was a great Ford guy. So it's like, yeah, it's pretty cool.
That $75 intake would be worth $175 now.
At least. Collector's item.
That engine is in our show, in our lobby.
Really?
It's in our lobby.
That's cool.
I saved that engine, so that was over.
That's like awesome.
45 years ago, and that engine got moved around from, you know, plant addition to new plants, and finally, one day, I said, get that engine out, and let's put it back together. And it's like, it's missing a piston. I don't give a shit. We're not going to run it.
Still probably make more horsepower than a flathead.
It probably would, yeah.
That's
cool. Yeah.
Best piece of advice that you've ever received?
Most of the good advice that I've received is related to not giving up, hanging in there, you know, don't quit. And I think... You know, I started off as a one-man shop. So from then till now, there's been times when things were really hard and you screwed up enough or whatever. And I would say just any advice about just don't quit, hang in there. There's times, and this is a long time ago now, I'm very fortunate, but there was probably times when quitting would have been a good idea. And if you quit, nobody would have blamed you. You know, your mom would have said, oh, that's okay. You tried your hardest. You know, that's good. But good advice is make a decision that most people won't make and don't quit and just keep going. And as soon as you do that, you separate yourself from most of the small business people who fail or struggle. So that's not based on wisdom. That's based on bullheadedness. So I had a few people that would help me that way. Encourage me that way.
And I'm gonna say it, and you could hold me to that. After almost 2 years, that's the single best piece of advice I've heard.
Awesome.
Love it. That's good, good stuff.
Real good. Favorite car movie?
Yeah, you know, I heard you ask that before, and I can't even think of a favorite car movie.
Favorite movie? Take the car part out.
You know how you get guests on who can recite lines out of movies?
Uh-huh.
I'm not that guy. I like movies, but I'm like, okay, that was fine. Let's go to work.
Next.
Most of my tail end words are, let's go to work.
Okay.
That was nice. Let's go to work. My mom gives my dad hell because she says, all you taught them boys is how to work. He's like, well, you know, when I was coming up, my dad was always worried about getting ahead. He said, so that's what we taught our kids, is how to get ahead. Just go to work.
Seems like it worked out all right. You built a hell of a career for yourself. So.
I asked Dad the other day, I said, hey, you know, you're getting older. I said, you're going to put up a fight if it's time to put you in a care home someday? And he said, nope. He says, one thing I don't want, I said, I don't want you guys taking care of me because I want you to go to work. Like, okay, Dad. All right. We'll lock you up. All right.
Got off easy.
Taking you off your game.
No, you're fine. I'm listening. Black coffee or cream and sugar?
Milk. A little bit of milk.
Really?
Yeah.
No sugar, just a little bit of milk.
No sugar. Not big on sugar.
I wasn't expecting that.
Don't eat. I don't like sweets. Don't care about cake. Not my favorite thing. I like meat.
Meat?
Yeah.
Steak?
Steak. And so I have high blood pressure. And I'm on so many blood pressure meds that once in a while my blood pressure is low. I called my doctor one time on the weekend because it's that kind of doctor. I texted him. I said, hey, Brad, my blood pressure is like super low. He said, eat some salt. I'm like, this is freaking great.
Eat some salt.
Yeah.
Well, we do a pocket dump. You got anything in your pockets?
I do.
All right.
Not much. I've got... Well, I'll let you describe it.
Oh, that's two
that's
things
the before
of winter,
and after.
That's two things of wintergreen. I don't even think I can flip it anymore. I couldn't. I used to be able to.
You used to know how to do that?
Yeah.
And you cleaned up your act?
I started smoking cigarettes.
I don't know if you cleaned up his
act. I could pack a pack. Skoal Wintergreen. You got a ring in your pocket, in your back? You keep it in the front pocket, didn't you?
What?
You kept this in the front pocket?
Front pocket, yeah.
And then a Wintergreen Mint.
Yeah. That's because the airplane that we fly in, you sit pretty close to each other. That's a consideration to my people that I'm with.
Man, it's been awesome, Norris.
Been great.
Instagram at blueprint_engines and then blueprintengines.com.
Yep.
They can check you out at SEMA here coming up soon, right?
That's right. And we have a great staff of people that work directly with our customers, and just call in and talk to them. They'll take care of you. They'll help you out. They'll answer your questions. We know that engines are, you know, kind of pricey, and sometimes you need to plan ahead and you need a little background, and we want to be supportive. We love our customers. Where we're at.
We have one staff member that's here off camera. He was quiet the whole time, too.
Yep.
He didn't say one word.
If Kel Bridge is here, Kel is the sales manager for Blueprint Engines, and he works his butt off to take care of customers and make sure everybody gets what they want.
Should we give Kel's cell phone number out for all the customers to call if they need anything?
I think there's an 800 number on the website. That would probably be adequate.
Thanks again for listening to Oil and Whiskey with the Roadster Shop and Ironclad Original. If you like the show, be sure to leave us a rating, review, all the blah, 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 or just tune in again next week.
Yeah.
See ya.